Fantastic.
We're all very cuddly in the Weevil area. Yeah, the last time I did one of these, it was on the lice and the Zoraptera and the Embioptera, and I took an hour or so to tell you in some detail about some 5,000 species of insects. This time, because I'm dealing with the weevils and to an extent with the Chrysomeloidea, I'm actually talking about something like 8% of all described species, which is kind of a bit more.
3 hours?
If you're lucky. Okay. So weevils are kind of neat. I'll start off with that basic premise. And for those of you who don't know, that is real, that monument. That is the only monument I know of to a pest species. That is the boll weevil monument in Enterprise, Alabama. And the only thing I've missed out are the two lights on the side and the fountain around the base. It's a fabulous thing. Phytophaga. Two superfamilies, Chrysomeloidea, Cuculionoidea. Round about 50,000, 60,000 species in Chrysomeloidea, maybe 60, 70 in weevils, and those are the ones we've described so far. And the numbers are very much open to revision. When I went looking on the web for numbers of Chrysomeloidea or Chrysomelidae, I got between 20,000 and 50,000 according to the website I went to. We haven't quite counted them all yet. That's a brief, it's a rather scrappy cladogram that came out of Farrell's work a few years ago, with the weeviloids at the top there and the chrysomeloids down here. Don't try and pay any attention to that. Again, we haven't got fully resolved cladograms at tribal, subfamily, family level yet. There are still issues in both superfamilies. But the main point there is we think they're probably sister groups, the two together. Similarly, with the family status, the families in both superfamilies, there is quite a lot of argument. This arrangement of the chrysomeloids is out of Lawrence and Newton, and I think it's the one we follow in the collection. It doesn't really matter. There are a number of ways you can task it. You can break that up into several families. You can unite those. You can bring the brookines out. Different people do different things. This works as well as any other, I guess. And the sorts of things that in the chrysomeloids that we recognise quite a lot are Chrysomelidae themselves and the Cerambycidae, the longhorns. The other two there are rather smaller groups. The Cuculionoids, there are lots more families accepted. Whether that is in any sense realistic, this does to an extent follow the phylogeny we think is right, though there are issues. Nemonychidae are not monophyletic. Atlabidae, Rhynchitidae probably go together as a monophyletic group, and so on and so on. I'll probably come back to that a bit later on. But rather more families, a few more weevils. One of the things I had problems with in trying to deal with this number of organisms in a talk like this was to think, well, just how do I structure it? What do I do? What do I talk about? Do I go through one by one by one? That's a bit tedious. Do I go through family by family? Well, that's a bit tedious as well. This feeds on plants, that feeds on plants, forget it. The big problem is just why there are so many. So what I thought I'd do is look around a bit of the natural history of these things, and then maybe, given time, come back to a bit more discussion about why there are so many. Now, there have been a number of hypotheses as to why there are so many Phytophagus beetles around. That's one. God, the inordinate fondness for beetles. There are a huge number of Phytophagus beetles. What we're dealing with the Phytophaga, oops, I'll go back, is something around 50% of all insects that feed on plants. It's a vast number. One of the other theories, hypotheses, reasons, was to do with food, what the things feed on. If you're a carnivore, if you're a predator, it seems you're more limited than the number of species you can get. The diversity is a bit lower. And it's been suggested that actually feeding on plants, being a Phytophagous animal, enables you to increase your species numbers. And there's been work looking at Phytophagous beasties and their sister groups. And generally in that work, it was shown that the Phytophagous animals were far more species rich than their sister groups, which did something different. So that's one theory, that because these things feed on plants, there are that many more of them. Indeed, as I said, there's a huge number of Phytophaga. This is a vast group, 80% of plant-feeding beetles, 50% of all plant-feeding insects, a vast number. And maybe it is that amongst beetles, they really made the move into plants, plant feeding, and that's the reason for how many there are. So what sort of things they do on plants? I think it's probably a bit of time to think about just what the animals are doing. Basically, any bit of plant you can find is going to have some of these things in it somewhere. Quite a lot of them take pollen at some stage or another. A lot of the basal groups do, Nemenicidae in the weevils, for example. But you quite often find them sitting on pollen, eating pollen, just before they overposit. And this seems to occur both in the curculionoids and some of the chrysomeloids. Not all of them by any means. And certainly there are very few real observations in comparison to the number of species we've got. One of the big problems we have in looking at any sort of plant association is, A, you've got both the adult form and the larval form. And B, it's quite difficult to tell from looking at where you collect, certainly the adult, what it's doing there. A beetle might be on a plant because it's feeding on it. It might be on a plant because its larva fed on it and it's just emerged and sitting around. It might be on a plant because that's where it has sex. It might be up on a plant because that's where it just feeds. There are some chrysomeloids which have a particular plant species they go and sit on to defecate. So it'll move on to one species just to produce frass, then move back onto the thing they feed on. So just collecting adults is not necessarily a good indication of what the things are actually feeding on. Adults and larvae may or may not feed on the same plants. In most cases, we simply don't know. So a lot of our host information right across is terribly patchy. We've got quite a lot, but in comparison with the number of species, it's not hugely good. In terms of pollen feeding, of course, since quite a number of them are pollen feeders, you get some pollinators there. You can get some quite important pollinators there. One of the really important ones is the million-dollar beetle, Halidobius camerunicus. Pollinates oil palms, originally found in Ghana, and is now used all over the world, pollinating oil palms. What people used to do was to go in with paintbrushes and gently transfer bits of pollen from flower to flower. Now they release beetles, and the beetles do it for them. But in fact, that beetle is one of a swarm. If you go to Ghana, you'll find five or six species, all in the same genus, all mucking around on the palm flowers at once. And quite often, you'll see pollinating swarms of weevils, masses of them all on the same flowers, particularly on palms. Wood, of course. Well, serendipity, we all link serendipity with wood, longhorn beetles and burrowing into wood. This is the locust borer. And that's locust trees after the locust borer has done its bit. A lot of wood-boring beetles are serious problems. And a lot of weevils and a lot of chrysomeloids have gone into wood. It seems like a really good place for a beetle to go and live. And they do it in a number of different ways. This thing tunnels up inside the wood. This, on the other hand, twig girdles. Twig girdling is because it seems that the larva, which develops in the wood, isn't terribly good at coping with live wood. Obviously, when the plant's fully live, it's producing all sorts of defences against being eaten. So what the twig girdler does is to just put that ring around the outside of the twig, lay the egg in the end bit, which starts dying. And after a little while, it'll fall off. And you can see where twig girdlers are being, because you get this sort of massive twigs all lying on the ground. So it's reduced the plant defences and allowed its larva to develop in the wood in peace, I guess. Bark beetle is another one we all know. Scelitidae, according to most people, but Scelitinae because they're a subfamily of Curculionidae, according now to systematists. This seems pretty clear, is what these are. Lots and lots of species. And if you pull a piece of bark off a dead tree, you'll quite often find these lovely radial galleries. Each species has a different sort of gallery. You can tell the species apart from the gallery form. Most of them are just under the bark. Some go further in. Platypodidae, which is a related group, Platypodinae, tend to go straight in. And certainly people have attempted to map the the burrows by injecting latex into trees and then taking away the wood. So you're left with this lovely skeletal burrow form as a model. Skeletines feed on fungus. I mean, a lot of things, it's not necessarily clear what they're feeding on in the wood. They might be feeding on the wood itself, in which case they might be able to digest it, or they might have a symbiotic flora inside their guts to help them digest it. Or they might just be feeding on something else like fungus. And skeletines introduce fungus, and they browse on that. You've got a section of a bit of tree there with a blue stain of fungus that's been put into the tree by this beetle. And the tree is probably dead. Well, it's dead. It's been cut down, for God's sake. Dutch elm disease in this country, skeletines, spreading a fungus. Those of you who have been to Belize, to the field station there, you'll have gone through Mountain Pine Ridge. If you've gone through recently, you'll find it isn't Mountain Pine Ridge anymore. It's Dead Pine Ridge, because at least 3/4 of the pine trees there have been killed. And they've been killed by fungus introduced by skeletines. They can be absolutely devastating. And there's a huge quarantine effort on most ports to keep these things out. Certainly around the UK, some of these things could create real havoc in our pine forests in particular. What's kind of neat about them is that you don't just get one beetle feeding on everything. They really divide up the tree between themselves. So you'll find different species on different trees. You'll find even on one tree, different species going for different bits of the tree according to its branch diameter or the trunk diameter. If you look on fallen wood, you'll find different species on that than it is if the wood's still dead on the tree. And you can actually start picking up what beetles you're going to find according to the size of wood you pick up. You also get them feeding on seeds. The Diptrocarp seed work I'm doing, there are skeletines coming in and feeding on the pericarp of the seed after it's fallen. And when there aren't any seeds, they go and live in the leaf petioles of the trees themselves, of the fallen leaves. So according to what food resource is there, they're doing different things. But they're doing quite restricted things. And as I said, they can be serious pests. The Asian longhorn beetle has been one of the latest biggest scares, both in the UK and particularly in North America. And people got terribly, terribly excited about this and were cutting down trees if they saw a small hole in them. They can be bad news, certainly. They're not necessarily always bad news. I suppose linked to that, stem boring in things without all that great amount of wood. So a lot of beetles are going, a lot of these Phytophaga are feeding inside stems of green plants. There's a little larva going up and down inside the stem. This is the soybean stem borer, another longhorn. If you can see just the holes in the stem there. This will quite comfortably kill the plant. And it gets a nice safe place to be inside the substrate. And this is one of the themes perhaps of both groups, that it's a safe place to be inside the substrate, inside the plant when you're feeding. Another place inside, of course, is seeds. And seeds, nice, really rich source of food. And a lot of weevils, both weevils and true weevils, true weevils and seed weevils, Brookine there, as a chrysomeloid, of course, feeding inside seeds. That's one of my Alcedodes, feeding on a Diptrocarp seed. It's just come out, looking around the world, seeing what's going to happen next. Acorn weevil, just happily lying in the middle of the seed there, eating it up. There is a range of host specificity here, and host specificity, although I said that we don't necessarily know what things are feeding on, the more you look, the more you can find out. There's a great Brookine genus feeding on a tree in Central America. I think it's 7 species of Brookine, congeneric, on one species of tree, and you can find them all on one single tree. And they're just dividing up the tree between them, different bits of the tree they're going for. There's a weevil genus feeding on Hymena, another tree in Central South America. And I think there are 14 species in the genus, and they all feed on fruit of the one tree, bar one. It's gone onto a different tree and decided to be different. But they just do things in slightly different ways. In Costa Rica, there are 2 species of this genus, Rhynchinus. There's a sort of tough, rough one, and that it was a rather sort of wimpy one. The fruit pod of this, the tree, Hymena, gets very, very hard when it gets old. When it's young, it's sticky, and the female can't oviposit. When it's just in the middle before starting to mature, it gets quite dry, and the female can oviposit. And then when it gets old, it gets very, very tough. And of these two species of weevils, one, when it's gone through its life cycle inside the seed, it's emerged inside the seed in the fruit as an adult, and it eats its way out. The other one can't do that. The other one is just a bit too weak. And it sits inside the seed pod until the seed pod's opened by an agouti coming to feed on the seeds. The insect itself looks like a decaying seed. So when the agouti opens the seed pod, it curls up its legs and sort of rolls out onto the ground and hopes the agouti doesn't spot it. And if it does spot it, it doesn't want to eat it. The result of this, of course, is in the parts of Costa Rica where the agouti's been shot out and eaten, the beetle's gone extinct as well. The other thing down here, Alcedodes, that one, the specificity there seems to be slightly different, that any one species of Alcedodes on Dipterocarps will feed on up to 26 species of host, and that can be in one site. And you can, on one species of tree in one site, get up to 6 species of the genus. Now, there are preferences within that. There's a whole range of hosts it can exploit if it needs to. Seed feeding, of course, it's a neat way of biocontrol. This is an apian species, a weevil, and it's been used to control gorse in New Zealand. Gorse, European plant, introduced into New Zealand. Cows don't like it, so you get fields covered in gorse, and cows sitting rather miserably on the outside wondering where all the grass went. Apian can take up about 98% of seeds if it's on a really good infestation. So it's a good biocontrol method. Another difference in seed predators, so if seed predators as though things run away, but that's what they're called, is quite where they pupate. The old acorn weevil, the larva will come out of the acorn once it's finished its stalk, when it's finished developing, and will drop into the soil and pupate in the soil. And the adult will emerge maybe 1, 2, 3 years later. Whereas a lot of the Dipterocarp weevils, that's a Dipterocarp seed cut open, the weevil's actually gone, because the weevil pupates inside the seed and the adult emerges and leaves the fruit before it drops from the tree. It's just a different way of doing things. And you get a whole range of different ways of attacking seeds, different ways of developing from seeds. Another part of the plant, you're getting the idea, they kind of like plants, don't you? Another part of the plant is the roots. Here we've got a bit of sweet potato with psyllus weevils in it. I quite forget what sort of root that is, but it's crassomelid larvae on it. Quite a lot of larvae in roots, on roots, around about roots. Generally, we think, certainly with the weevils, they're less specific if they're feeding on roots as larvae. But the amount of information on root feeding is really, really low. And again, a lot of them make galls, again, in both groups. That one's a cerambycid gall. There's an apian gall. There's another weevil gall in a flower of a thistle. Hitting the plant, making the plant produce gall tissue, and then feeding on that tissue. Again, you're inside, which is a nice safe place to be if you're a baby beetle. And the plant's producing your food for you, which is jolly nice of it. A number of weevils feed on galls they don't make themselves, the old acorn weevil. Okay, the acorn weevil itself, Cochilio, it feeds inside the acorn, but a number of its relatives feed on galls. Not their own, they'll find somebody else's gall and go in that. And sometimes they'll eat not only the gall tissue, but the larva of the insect that created the gall in the first place. And leaf feeding. Well, Crassomelidae, leaf beetles. Any way you can get at a leaf, one of these beetles is going to get at it. Either tramping around happily on the outside of it, or mining in the middle of it. And there are an awful lot of leaf miners, both in the weevils and the Crassomelids, feeding on that lovely, lovely food. And you'll find them in different parts of the leaf. Even on the same plant, you might find different beetles, either mining on the edge of the leaf or along the midrib of the leaf, leaves on different parts of the plant, leaves on different times of the year. And again, I'm focusing on the larvae. A lot of the adults you'll find eating the leaves, just as you saw in that early slide. So the adults will be feeding on leaves as well, but not necessarily the same plants. And leaf rolling, this is an atlabid. Beautiful head. I always think atlabids look rather sort of keen and interested in what's going on. These things, just like the leaf rollers, they're taking off the twig girdlers, they're taking off a bit of the plant and making it sick and making it die, because the larva's going to find it easy to survive in that, rather easier than feeding on a bit of plant that's still alive and producing lots of anti-insect chemicals. And the beetle will roll up a bit of leaf really quite tight and lay the egg in the middle of it. There's the larva just laid on, that's nearly ready to pupate. It's been happily feeding on that leaf tissue in the middle. Actually, rolling a leaf like that is a bit tricky. It's not an easy job. And it takes the insect quite a long time to do that. And having done that, to make sure the leaf doesn't actually fall off the plant before it's had a time to lay an egg in it. So there's another group, several other groups in this, the Rhynchidae, which have evolved to steal a leaf roll. And they'll come along to a leaf roll that's already been made. They'll lay their own egg in it. The larva will eat the egg or larva of the previous incumbent, or the adult itself will in some groups, and its own larva will develop in the leaf roll. So a nice bit of habitat theft there. Quite a few weevils just eat eggs or larvae of other insects as part of the process. Not a huge number in comparison, but every now and again you find this cropping up amongst the weevils, a little bit of facultative carnivory. There's a weevil, Ludovix, which feeds, the larva feeds in near Katina, waterweed. And the adult will actually find a place where a grasshopper has laid its egg in the plant, will eat one of the eggs itself, and will lay its own egg on top of the egg raft of the grasshopper, and the larva will eat those grasshopper eggs, which is a bit of a nuisance because the grasshopper is being used as biocontrol of that plant. A little digression. As you all know, grown-up beetles have legs. That's one of the things they're known for. Not quite like that, necessarily. And the legs tend to be fairly adapted to the things that the beetle does. Here's a couple of weevils. This thing, it's feeding. It's in South America, Central America. Big waxy leaf plants, and it's got big tarsal pads there to hold onto the waxy leaves. Whereas here we've got a water weevil, a bagus. You see the tarsi there are really narrow. This photograph's taken underwater. You can just see the bubble there of oxygen, of air rather. And the scales do hold as a plastron, air on them when it's underwater. But it doesn't need great big thick tarsal pads to hold on because it's really clawing its way across the plants. So a quite different leg structure. And beetle legs kind of get kind of bizarre. We'll see another couple of bizarre ones later on. Well, there's one bizarre one. This is a flea beetle, Altisine, and you can see there, big enlarged hind femur. That's got a spring inside it. And if you've seen these things, little blue flea beetles on plants, and they'll sort of boing all over the place when you start disturbing them. Very good jumpers. And just to make the point, there's a weevil that does it too. There's an Orchestes weevil. Again, it's got a metafemoral spring in its hind femur, doing much the same thing. And most larvae have legs. There's a Chrysomeda larvae, lovely bead legs. But the weeveloids tend not to. Some of the primitive weevils have legs, but most of them do not. Most of them are inside the substrate, and they don't need legs. Legs are a bit of a nuisance. Even quite large ones don't have legs. This is a palm weevil larva. It's not very happy, that one, by the look of it. But you can find these things in the meristems of palm trees, killing the palm tree. They're quite good. If you can find them, if you just put them on a piece of wood and roast them over a small fire, a bit of orange juice and pepper, they're quite nice. And of course, the palm heart is a nice bit of vegetable dough with it. We get recipes of weevil talks as well. Not having legs doesn't seem to bother some of the weevils from living on the outside of plants. This one happily is covered in a sort of slime and it's happily going over the leaf on the outside. It's a nasty looking weevil. I suspect it tastes nasty and it seems to avoid being predated quite well. In this country, quite a lot of the Cyonis on Scrophulariaceae sitting on the outside of the leaves. Again, they're quite sticky. It's another weevil, Hypera. The larva there is not slimy. It actually moves quite a lot faster than these things. So it's escaping by both colour and being able to move a bit more rapidly. But it is managing to hold on the outside. Another nice little bit of parallelism between the two superfamilies. These are both larvae that live in water. This is a Danasiine larva. And at the end of the larva there is a couple of hooks. And it uses those to puncture the cells of the roots of the water plants to extract air. And the spiracles are just at the base of the spines. And that's how it's breathing when it's underwater. This is a rice water weevil. In this case, it's got spines along its back. And it's doing exactly the same. The spiracles have migrated up and they're sitting underneath the spines and it's puncturing the plant cells and the roots and taking air from them and managing to stay underwater. Water-dwelling weevils can be really successful. This is a Cerdobagus weevil. There it is, rather sweet little thing. And this is a lake in Queensland. It was a water weed introduced from South America, Salvinia. And that's a lake in northern Queensland, a couple of years after Salvinia was introduced. This is not good. It forms rafts about a metre deep after a while. It takes up a huge amount of oxygen, it kills all the fish. It really makes the water stagnant, so the mosquito populations build up hugely. That is the same lake about 8 months after that weevil was introduced. The weevil destroyed tens of tons of the weed over a few months. It built up huge populations, vast populations, and it's absolutely specific to that weed. It's one of the really good biocontrol stories. And one of the really good parts about it is that when the biocontrol people first went to South America to look for something to feed on the plant, they saw a weevil, picked it up, brought it back, bred it up to huge numbers, released it, and it did nothing because they got the wrong weevil. And it wasn't until the taxonomists got involved, actually started dissecting and looking at these things, they got the right weevil. It's a nice story to just underline the necessity of getting taxonomy involved early in the process rather than late on. Some things don't feed on plants, they feed on fungus. The anthribids, fungus weevils, have really broadened out into that area. So that's a quick leap through some of the things the plants feed on, some of the ways they feed on plants. And I'm going to go now into a little bit of morphology. And you just saw in that last slide, there's a rather sweet little weevil. It's got quite a long flat rostrum. And the antennae have got a little bit silly there. And quite a lot of these things, the antennae get very silly, particularly in the males. There we've got a male, a female are the same thing. And sometimes the antennae can be, as in that top one, several times the length of the body. They seem to be used during copulation. Here we've got a male, the female's ovipositing, the male is just waving its antennae around. Quite a well, where it's been looked at, which is not nearly as many places as we need to have looked at, the sperm competition is such that it's the last male to copulate with the female, which fertilizes the eggs. So the male weevils tend to stand around waiting for the female to oviposit before going away and leaving her, just in case another male comes around. And in this case, I suspect the antennae are part of a sort of perimeter warning system to make sure there's no other male around. And if there is a male around, the animal can take some sort of action about it. Another bit of sexual dimorphism, I'm sorry I don't have a picture of the male of this one, is the rostrum in the weevil. I'm sorry we're really hitting on weevils for a while. We'll come back to a few crassomeloids again soon. This one's a cycad weevil. Lovely long rostrum there. That's actually quite a short rostrum for that female. You can get them as long again as the body. The male has a rostrum which goes about that much. Huge diversity, difference between males and females sometimes. And the reason for this is that the weevils have, or the higher weevils, have given up having a nice tough ovipositor to drill into the substrate legs. They do it with their mouths instead. The weevil will drill there into the substrate, turn around, push the ovipositor down the hole formed, and lay the egg. And what is really sad to see is a female weevil which has spent 10 minutes, 15 minutes drilling a hole, turn around and completely fail to find the hole again with the other end. You can see the increasing desperation of this thing probing the substrate, wondering where on earth the hole's gone. And after a while she gives up and it sort of and slinks away with the antennae drooping. It's very, very sad. A good thing about having your larva developing in a substrate like this inside the plant is that quite often parasitoids can't find it. Inside the plant, it's a much more constant environment than outside the plant. It's a much safer place to be inside than outside. And this, like feeding on plants, has been put up as a really good reason why there are so many weevils. It's less effective for the chrysomeloids, of course, because although quite a lot of them are inside plants as larvae, not quite so many as the weeveloids. But the development of the rostrum as an overposition drill and living inside plants have both been given as reasons why there are so many, why the diversity. It is, of course, a bit of a trade-off here. Here we've got an acorn weevil, really long, slender rostrum, and as I said, the mouth is at the end of it. Now, in this case, the mouth operates, the mandibles operate in a slightly bizarre way. Most beetle mandibles are operating like that. They're closing together. That seems kind of sensible, doesn't it, now? There are a few weevil mandibles which have lost the plot and are going like that, operating against one another. These ones are operating like that. So very, very, quite rapid movements sometimes and rubbing against one another. And what this seems to be doing is feeding on very, very tender shoots. It was believed it didn't feed at all, but they do. They'll feed on very tender leaves and mash them up and suck up an almost fluid bit of plant. And that's great if you've got some tender leaves. It's a really, really good drill, but it's not terribly good at feeding on a wide variety of plant matter. Whereas that is less effective as a drill, but it's got a better base for the mandibles to chomp up quite tough bits of plant. So there's a trade-off going on between the sort of toughness of plant that the weevil can ingest and the efficacy with which it can deposit its egg inside the substrate. And that's really almost the extreme. That's a scalitine. This thing's boring into wood, and it needs a lot of support inside the head capsule. So if you look inside the head capsule of one of these things, you've got huge struts and bars, you've got vast, strong muscles and tendons, and you've got a very broad rostrum with heavy seating on the mandibles. So the trade-off's going quite the other way there. It's not drilling at all, it's drilling itself in rather than drilling its rostrum in. That's just a side issue. That's a Cossonine weevil, and that feeds in fairly decayed wood, and that sort of pushes itself, its whole body through. It's acting a bit like a wedge. So obviously with a little short rostrum, you've got a different way of depositing eggs. You can't drill into a substrate so well. So what a lot of the weevils with a broad rostrum do, they put their egg on the soil, or just inside the soil. So the broad rostrum weevils, the short-nosed weevils as we call them, the larvae are feeding on roots inside the soil, whereas a lot of the long-nosed weevils are feeding, the larvae are feeding on or in plants above the soil. The short rostrum forms can deal, at least theoretically, with much tougher bits of plant than some of the long rostrum forms. Occasionally, the male's rostrum is rather longer than the female. I said earlier on, you quite often find the female rostrum longer. In this case, it's a brentid weevil. The male there, very long rostrum. But you do see that the antennae are inserted right at the end, Whereas a female, there's that about there. And that's because the female is still using this as a drill, and the last thing it wants is the antennae getting in the way. So the female has the antennae pushed further back towards the head. The male has them right at the end because the male wants this nice sensory area. They can detect other males or what else is going on. And here you have, there's the female, she's overpositing, and the male really straddling and making sure that no other male is coming around. In this case, this is the male, they're just fun, these things. This is the male brented, it's the female brented. The male brented is even more possessive than most weevils. And when it's copulating, when the female is overpositing, it just grasps around the neck with its mandibles and holds on tight because she is not getting away. It's another nice bit of difference here. That's a male harlequin beetle. You see the forelegs there. The forelegs of the female are much, much shorter. So another bit of sexual dimorphism. And in mating, it seems like the male is holding on to the female. Again, maybe making sure she doesn't go away. Now, I don't know much more about this story, and I'm not convinced that that's the whole story. But we've got at least that sort of observation. And the male using the long legs to hold on. And the bottle brush weevil. This is one of my favorite weevils. This is a male. He's got this lovely tuft on his rostrum. And at the moment there, he's just stroking the female because the female likes to be wooed, likes to be treated nicely. And he's just stroking the back of the female with a brush. She particularly likes it on the thorax. A lot of female weevils, you see the males during the courtship area, just sort of patting the female's thorax, pronotum. In this case, there is some violence because the males also use that as a weapon. And the males will involve themselves in flipping competitions with each other, with the rostrum, a sort of very crude use of it, rather like a saber. One of the entertaining things about this thing is it comes in a variety of different sizes. According to where on the fallen palm tree the larva fed, it's either really large, and you're talking about 3 centimetres more, or it's really quite small, and it can be as small as a centimetre. Now, there is no way a little male bottle brush weevil, a centimetre long, is going to be able to take on a big male bottle brush weevil, 3 centimetres long, in a fight. So what the little males do is hang around and while the big guys get on with it, having a fight. And whilst the female's sitting there looking sort of miserable and left alone, he'll come up, have a little wipe with his rostrum and just enjoy and go away again. It seems to work. Quite a lot of weevils, quite a lot of both weevils and crassamoloids do fight. This is kind of weird. There's the male, there's the female. We don't know quite how this thing operates. It does seem to be a competition, a fighting device. It's been suggested it uses it to create the leaf roll, but I don't think there's any justification for that. One suggestion is it has a sort of nodding contest, and the one with the deepest nod is the one that's the victor. Another, given the strength of the joint there, is it actually is flipping the opponent. These things are not uncommon. This one comes from Madagascar. You find similar things right across to Southeast Asia. And yet the only observations I've seen of behaviour are in the BBC Wildlife magazine and the Beano Book of Amazing Animals. I'm not actually looking anymore because I just want to quote the Beano Book of Amazing Animals in my citation in the paper. This is not a complete weevil, for those who are confused. We've lost the abdomen there. This is one of the horned weevils. Quite a lot of weevils in a couple of subfamilies have horns sticking out of the thorax in the front. This is a male, of course. Females don't. But between them, there's a pit. And the pit goes into this huge, long sheath. There we are. That's just the thorax. There's the horns, and there's a sheath coming through. And what these things seem to do, is to engage in pushing competitions. So one male will insert the horn into the sheath of the other, and in this case, just push. And that's kind of cool. But in this case, the sheaths actually diverge. And what this one seems to do, well, there's only been one observation on one species, but it seems to be a reasonable thing to extrapolate, is the males cooperate the horns point outwards, the sheaths point outwards, they get the horn inside the other one and then twist to try and pull the other one off the substrate. And because you get males with different horn lengths in one species, they have to find another male with the same horn length and the same sheath length, otherwise it isn't going to work. So there's a lot of collaboration and cooperation before they can get down to the serious business of fighting. In this case, this is another male, it's a palm beetle, and you see there in the inside of the legs, a nice bit of red. Some of these things you get orange hairs down the same area. And what these do, in order to frighten a predator, or maybe, and we don't know, display against one another, is rear up and put their legs up like that to give this bright flash of colour. It's called the prancing mode, in the only paper that's written about it. But again, this is either, it's display of some sort, whether against another male, because only the males have it, or against a predator as well. Which brings me on to colour, I guess. Because we do have some really nice coloured beetles here. There was, for anybody interested, a magazine in the 30s, I think, called The Blue Beetle. You do indeed get blue beetles. Okay, a lot of these, the weevils and the chrysomeloids and the cerambycids, aren't beautifully bright colours, but quite a lot of them really are. These are natural colour. These are the colours the animals actually are. And you do get very silly colours. Spots, stripes, you name it. These are really some of my favourites. It's tempting to believe that Richard in his younger days spent time painting the back of these things, but I don't think he did. Actually, those things come from the Philippines. And it seems to be that if you're living in the Philippines and are about this sort of size, then having spots on your back is a really good thing to do. It's evolved at least four times in the Phytophaga. I know of three weevil groups where it's happened, and one cerambycid group where it's happened. There may be others. Why? I have no idea. A lot of the colours don't actually look as bright when you see them in the wild as they do sitting in a drawer. Those things look quite dramatic in the drawer, but once you actually go in the field and start looking on leaves, underneath leaves, you'll see the green just sort of blurs in. You don't see them very much. That one, obviously, it's a little weevil sitting in the desert, and nothing's going to see that. Over here, we've got an anthribid, and that's pretending to be a piece of bird shit. And quite a few of them are looking like bird shit, one way or another. Even quite large beetles can sort of drift away. These are big, big beetles. And yet you think of those on a piece of wood or sitting on the forest floor, they would just go. You wouldn't see them. And some are just silly. I mean, that is just bizarre. If that is the right way up, there's the margin between the abdomen and the elytra. There's the head down there. I don't know what it's pretending to be, but it certainly isn't pretending to be a beetle. These things, a couple of hispines, covered in sort of mess. The larvae are leaf miners there. And again, when I first saw that photograph, I thought, what is that? Again, it doesn't look a lot like a beetle. And one assumes the predators aren't going to think it looks like doesn't look a lot like a beetle either. Quite a few of them have the legs which will just fold in like that, and they'll drop. And you'll find pretending to be a seed, pretending to be nice and streamlined, so they'll fall off the plant, drop neatly through all the leaves and twigs underneath, and just look like a seed lying on the ground. And they'll stay all crunched up for quite a long time. Just a bit more on colours, because they're fun. The metallic colours of these things are produced in a number of different ways. The tortoise beetle there. Tortoise beetles, for those of you who haven't seen them, are absolutely fabulous. You'll see these things sitting on plants, and they'll be gold and green and shining and wonderful. And then you'll put them in a tube and kill them, and they'll go straw yellow quite fast. So whatever the colour method is, it's something that really is linked to the animal being alive. One of my greatest disappointments collecting in Southeast Asia early on, I collected a weevil, a lovely black weevil, with a bright pink cross on its back. I thought that was great. I was looking forward to getting it back here, and I put it into a tube of alcohol, and the cross dissolved because it was made out of wax, which is soluble in the alcohol. These things, I think, probably using interference. There's been some work done on at least one of the leaf beetles, cutting through the whole surface and finding a whole row of layers, transparent layers. And the light gets refracted through each of those layers, and what you get back is interference. And you find they change colour according to which way you're looking at them. And those earlier photographs, the sagra, the ones with which are the blue through to green to yellow, that's almost certainly that sort of coloration. Weevils, you do find some coloration like that. A lot of coloration is down to scales. And weevils do have scales, as many beetles do. In this case, you've got patches of iridescent scales. That's transmitted light, that's incident light. And there's something on the structure there. Some of the weevil scales are quite weird and wonderful shapes. Some certainly have striations on them, acting as diffraction gratings. One of the most entertaining scales, I think, is one that's been published on recently. That's again on one of these Pachyrhynchus. Scales look fairly normal, but if you cut into those scales, you find masses of tiny spheres all packed together. And this apparently is just the same way that opal makes its colour. So inside the scale, you've got a synthetic opal. Quite remarkable. Okay. That was sort of quick dance through bits of natural history. I'm going to wind up just looking at the weevil phylogeny. This is the phylogeny that Max produced a few years ago. Why so many weevils? The big numbers are up there in the Cicadonidae. That's where the huge numbers are. Because they're on plants, because they're feeding on plants. Well, okay, that's fair enough. Most of these, bar the Anthribidae, are feeding on plants, being alive or dead, being seeds or green matter. If it's a question of going onto plants and doing a bit of co-evolution, and as the plants diversify, so do the weevils, well, okay, in that case, you expect primitive host down the bottom and a derived host up the top. Kind of. Certainly Oxycorhinidae, you get on gymnosperms, you get them on cycads. Unfortunately, you only get one tribe on cycads, one subfamily on cycads, and the others are not. One subfamily is on Araucarias, but it also goes on to parasitic plants. Little parasitic plants sitting in the ground. They've got a flowering part above the ground. It's about the same size and shape as an Araucaria cone, which is where the others feed on. So I think they've just sort of shifted across because something was in the same place and the same size. It also had reproductive material in it. And these have moved on to dead plants, dead gymnosperms. But some of the Oxycorhinids are on angiosperms. Some of them, the most numerous group, are actually on almost anything dead in Hawaii. As you go up, you find, obviously, fungus feeders. A few here feeding on angiosperms. Quite a lot feeding on pollen. It seems very likely that pollen was an early, an ancestral food type. And it's been suggested that the reason why weevils have a rostrum is they develop this to push into plants to get at the pollen. Leaf rollers, leaf miners, again on derived plants. Moving up here, that's sitting in a very dry environment. Timber, feeding in sweet potatoes. Monocots, and then up monocots and into dicots. So there is some sort of parallelism, but it's really very weak. I think more why there are so many is that quite a lot of them are as much tissue associated as they are species associated or family associated. That they've managed to diversify within the architecture of the plants. And I remember a few years ago there was some work done on plant architecture. And according to how complex the plant was, so you could predict how many species of insect you're going to find on it. And these things in both superfamilies have really gone in to exploit that architecture. So any bit of plant they're going to go to. You get in the UK, three species on one plant, One's laying eggs on the midline of the rib, one's laying eggs on the right of the edge of the leaf, one's laying eggs on the stem. They diversified within the plant there, but kept put on different tissues. Others just sit on the same tissue and move from plant to plant to plant. You've had explosions of numbers going under fungus, perhaps, going into dead wood several times. You've had explosions of numbers with a change in morphology. The broad-nosed weevils. The ancestral certainly had a very long rostrum. Broad noses, it shrunk, perhaps with a period of dryness or only tough plants being available. And were able to exploit a new niche. Then, oddly enough, the long nose evolved again. And it was again, the animals were again able to take off and diversify. Going into wood as a scolitine and platypovine, that's one group it seems now. Again, a diversification with a simple morphological change, but enabling them to exploit a whole mass of new plant tissue. So there isn't, I think, one story why there are so many. I think there are lots of stories. It's not a simple hypothesis, this because of that, because I don't think you really get that in this sort of question. Each beetle, each insect has a new starting point, a new set of evolutionary baggage it's carrying with it. So what we have here is a whole mass of stories of exploitation of new tissue types or new species types. And that's why we get so many. And of course, they're still going. Thank you.
Get you to answer questions in a second, but I'll just ask one first before everybody else does. And that is the colourful examples in these groups. Do they? Is that aposematic? Do they store plant poisons?
Yes and no. Some of the colourful ones clearly are nasty. In fact, there's one species of, I think, Chrysomelid, which is used by the sand bushmen in southern Africa as arrow poison. And this is neat. This is sort of take your beetle, squeeze it on your arrow, plunge arrow into animal dies. Some of them, like the ladybirds, exude a substance from the joints. There's some questions whether that's nasty or not, but it's certainly off-putting. In most cases, we don't know. There have been very few coleopterists which have gone down the lepidopteral line of eating caterpillars. We just tend not to do that. And in most cases, we just don't know. Some of the weevils, huge bright colours, but very, very tough animals. I mean, if you want a job sometime, we've still got a few unpinned upstairs. Come and try and get a pin through. You know, collection management by and large don't like us using chisels and hammers, but hey. And it seems unnecessary to have an aposematic coloration, as well as being so really, really tough. Indeed so, yes. And a lot of things which look bright in the draw simply don't look bright in the field. They just look different in the field.
Okay, well, I'd like you to take questions from the audience, please. So would somebody start the ball rolling?
Can you repeat the question at the table, please?
Sure, Jim. Or not. Dick.
You mentioned that some weevils, or I got the impression that some weevils carnivorous, but only in sort of in passing. Are any of them in fact entirely carnivorous? Are we able to revert from basically a plant or fungus feeding diet to be completely dependent on animal food?
There is a dependency, I think, in some cases for a protein meal just before oviposition. So that is a dependency, if you like. Like Ludovic's, the Icornia grasshopper. Animal. That does seem a dependency. It's very rare. The anthropid I showed up there, that feeds on scale insects. And I think that's obligatory. Max, can you?
I think the larvae, yes.
Yeah. So a very few, but the majority not. It's not something they've really gone to do. And if you look at the gut structure of these things, they're set up as sort of generalist plant feeders. They haven't got a gut which is particularly well adapted to shifting into feeding on animals, insects. So it's a rare thing. It just does happen occasionally. Sorry, Jim did ask me and I completely forgot to do that. That was a question about predation in weevils.
I think you picked up there.
Oh, right.
Vic. It's a bit trivial, but there was a frog mimic in Kunong Mulu which fed in the axles of RAC or Musace or something, and it was a tail end that looked like a head of a frog. But when you brought it back, it was there was nothing there. I mean, it was just sort of hair. You couldn't see anything like a frog.
This is a question about frog mimicry in weevils, which is an unusual one, and one I'd expect from you, Vic. but yes, the weevils, as I said, have got a lot of scales. They've also got some that sometimes they're packed into tight hairs. There are several which do the sort of frog mimicry thing, not a huge number, but just every now and again you pick one up. And the eyes are either by a strong tuft of hairs or by a projection of the elytra themselves. It differs in different things. Or just by colour. If you look, I remember looking at one of the ones in New Zealand at the rear end and suddenly there was a pair of eyes staring back at me. Now, quite what size you have to be scared by this animal, I do not know. But they do seem to do mimicry in a number of different ways. There is a group of weevils in South Central America which go in for ant mimicry and fly mimicry. And the fly mimics are particularly astounding. They've got little red patches on either side of the pronotum. And you can see them sitting around on bits of wood, and they'll move just like a fly does. And if you disturb them, they'll fly up just like a fly does. And then they'll go hide somewhere just like a fly doesn't. I'm not entirely sure why they're pretending to be flies, but it's quite clear that's what they are trying to do. There's one in Southeast Asia which seems to be an Apilionid mimic. Very, very long legs. It sits around on the base of tree trunks, and it just sways just like a harvestman does. And it does seem to be trying to do the same thing. Again, I'm not sure why, whether it feels it's going to scare things off like that. But a number of them do mimic other organisms. A frog is probably about as large as it gets, but they are trying. And I can't resist in that context just to mention the New Guinea ones that mimic gardens. There's a subgenus in New Guinea. It lives only above 2,000 metres in one mountain range. And it's got little curved setae on its elytra and pronotum. And that encourages lichens and little bryophytes to set up house there. And there's a whole ecosystem tramping around. They live about 5 years. And there are lichens on their back and little rotifers that live only there. And it's great fun. And in fact, that's happened, I think, 3 times in different beetles in that same mountain range above 2,000 metres. I would say come and have a look at some in the collection, but some enthusiast quite a few years ago thought all these beetles looked a little bit messy and cleaned off the lichens, so we can't actually... Such a life. Malcolm.
Chris, there are plainly so many more species of weevils to be described. How comfortable though do you feel with the higher classification of the weevils? Is it workable? Have molecular methods come up with any good insights? Are you moving forward? That's a mirror.
A question about higher classification in view of the large number of weevils we've still got to find. Broadly, yes. In detail, I'm worried. Looking at this, which is done at the family level, the molecular work that Max was doing with Alfred and myself really showed the sign for those to be the basal group rather than a group comprising that, that, and that. Because that, those three, Nemonicidae, were considered to be the basal group. And molecular evidence showed up that pattern. We've since looked at morphology and found evidence which supports that. So in order to answer your second question, molecular evidence is certainly producing some interesting ideas which we can work with. It also showed up Microsaurians there as being Brentids, whereas previously they'd been put up there with a Brachyceridae. And they look nothing like Brentids. They're completely Brentids, long thin things sitting under wood. Microsaurians, short dumpy things wandering around deserts, for goodness sake. But no, the molecular evidence has shown that morphology confirms it, larval morphology as well as adult morphology. This broad arrangement, except we've got a toothbrush, it may twitch a bit, but I think we're nearly there. Up here, it's a nightmare. We will, I think, over the next few years, get these families sorted in relation to one another, and we're getting there. A few years ago, when Richard published his paper trying to sort out the classification there, it was unclear that you could do that, which is why he didn't. Now there is more evidence that you can do that, which is going to make things easier. The bit you can't see here, because it isn't resolved at all, is Caculionidae, which is where the vast number of species actually are. And there we're still really uncomfortable with some of the subfamilies, whether the subfamilies have got a monophyletic or not. I suspect a lot of them are not. The scolatines now seem to be fairly happily plugged in to the costanines. Platypodids slightly less so. But there's an awful lot to be done up there, and still it is not at all uncommon for someone to turn up with a specimen, what's this, and you can't even put it to subfamily. Whether more species are going to help clarify that or just make it even more difficult, I don't know. I think we probably could clarify it more than we have at the moment. But molecular evidence is turning some stuff up, as long as you get the right gene. The gene we started on simply didn't work because it was just not giving any resolution up there. There's still a lot of morphology to do. But because there are so many, because there is so much parallelism and convergence, and there really is, getting a picture which is at all convincing is quite tricky. But I plan to do it by about 3028. John.
This mess you've got on the top with Epionids and Caculionids and everything, am I correct in assuming this probably radiates sometimes to do with flowering plants?
Well, yeah, there's certainly been radiation on flowering plants. Whether they were with flowering plants is a moot point.
Now, would it be sort of about the same time?
Because yeah.
We get a similar problem, and I'm sure it's the same in other groups, that the groups that evolve rapidly about that time, you always end up with this brush, you can't resolve
it. Sure.
And they've got the same in time. All the groups that have where they rapidly evolve, corners and calcids, it's really impossible to sort of
The big radiation does seem to have been around that time. But it's certainly not parallel. There are bits that are parallel with flowering plants and bits which certainly are not.
It's
very rapid, yes. I do think, though, we can get a better resolution on it than we have at the present. I know it is clearly a problem, that rapid evolution, but I think it can be resolved. But it's going to take a while, and there will be arguments for a very, very long time. I think Terry's sitting on some open bottles at the back there, so.
That one's danced around over the entire Bible.